Well, now I'm delighted to welcome Lord Peter of Ingatestone Hall to Phoenix FM. So, good afternoon and welcome, Lord Peter.
Good afternoon to you.
Now, with a family with such deep roots as yours, it's difficult to know quite where to begin. But we've got to start somewhere, so perhaps I could start with Sir William Peter, who lived between 1505 and 1571, and amongst many other things, served as Secretary of State for no less than four Tudor monarchs, Henry VIII, Edward VI, and both Queens Mary the First and Elizabeth the First. But before we get onto that aspect, how was it that he was able to position himself to gain such high office in the first place? Or was it through the influence of the Boleyn family?
Well, I think that's probably right. He came from a very modest background. His family were farmers and tanners on the fringes of Dartmoor, but he got a scholarship to Exeter College, Oxford, became a Doctor of Civil Law, and then somehow, we're not quite sure how, became tutor to Anne Boleyn's elder brother, and as you suggest, thence went into the service of the king as one as Thomas Cromwell's assistants.
Now, going back to his service to so many Tudor monarchs, and given the religious controversies of the day, he must have been pretty adept at political manoeuvring. How on earth did he do it?
Well, actually, I think probably, if anything, the reverse is the case. He got himself a reputation for playing with a very straight bat indeed. He has been characterised as the first civil servant, whereas the common fashion of the day is everyone to be involved in plots and manoeuvrings, and he didn't do that. He felt his job was to execute the particular policy of the day in as humane and merciful a way as possible, and I think he got a reputation for that, and that is why he continued to serve. People felt they could trust him.
But do you think his position would have been less tenable, especially during Mary's reign, had he not been Roman Catholic?
Well, possibly. But as I say, I think he sort of made it clear that he was sort of above such considerations. He was always very careful not to shout out loud his his religious convictions.
Probably a good idea given the time.
Well, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. But in spite of his Catholicism, he succeeded in benefiting from the dissolution of the monasteries and even got Ingatestone Hall into bargain, didn't he?
Well, he did, but just like everyone else, I mean, the point of the dissolution of the monasteries, in which he was very heavily involved, he was one of the commissioners who actually roamed the country negotiating the surrender of the lands, but they were all surrendered to the king, who then duly sold them off in the open market. And you may say that William, because he'd been a visitor of the monasteries, knew which were the ones worth buying. But yes, indeed, he did, among other, purchase the manor of Ingatestone for its full commercial value of £849.12.6, payable in instalments. So
it was payable in instalments.
Oh yes, oh yes.
Well, I expect there was a lot of money in those days.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But just to add a sort of confirmation of that, he subsequently got a bull of forgiveness, as it were, from the Pope, saying that he was absolved for any blame in this seizing of church lands. Yeah. So long as he built almshouses in Ingatestone.
Oh, right.
And the almshouses which are there today, not on the original site, but still the same foundation, are those that he was called upon to build.
Now, as an aside from this, because I think that the Ingatestone Hall came basically from the sale of the Abbey of St. Mary's in Barking, I have a vague feeling that the abbess there, she also came off quite beneficially out of the sale of the dissolution of the monasteries, compared with a lot of others, didn't she?
Oh, well, that was how it very much worked, in that, you know, the lands weren't simply seized, that certainly the senior people in all the religious houses. I don't know about the ordinary monks and nuns. Yeah. Perhaps they were just thrown onto the street. I'm not sure. But certainly the abbots and abbesses were given a reasonable pension. And in fact, one of the sources of Sir William's fortune was the various incentives that the outgoing abbots and abbesses offered him in order to ensure that he would see that their pension was adequate. So it was how business worked in those days.
Well, you know. not so much has changed.
Absolutely.
Now, bearing in mind, though, that he'd be the one that had to originally tell the then Princess Mary that Mass couldn't be celebrated in her house, his position must have been a bit tenuous when she came to the throne, wasn't it?
Well, I think that rather sort of confirms what I said earlier, that he saw it as his task to execute the policy of the day, and I think probably Queen Mary would have understood this. He did it, I'm sure, in a very humane and gentle way, but made it clear that these rules were rules and she better stick to them. And so, you know, she probably acknowledged that later on. Because indeed, although he had served Edward VI, the extreme Protestant regime, virtually the first person that Queen Mary turned to when she ascended the throne was Sir William Petre. She called in at Ingatestone on her way to London to assume the throne.
I mean, it's amazing when you look at it, isn't it? Because because just prior to Edward's death, the Privy Council, of which he was a senior member, had limited the succession to Protestants only. And then he switched sides 2 months later. So that was an amazing bit.
Yes, but I think it's a symptom of the same thing I've been saying. Had become the established rule, and so he followed it.
But he had to somehow distance himself from that, didn't he? Not that much. Can't have been, you know. How on earth, you know, you've got to be fairly adroit, I would say, to manage to push one thing.
Certainly, he was very discreet indeed. Mm. But he wisely didn't get caught up in the Lady Jane Grey party, for instance. So he could see which way the wind was blowing, but he very much stuck to this thing is that, you know, we obey the current rule of law, as it were.
Yeah.
You know?
Because he had to do the same again with Elizabeth, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely.
Taught her in the Tower.
Absolutely.
It must have been
yes.
But, you know, whether you say that or not, I still think it's pretty good footwork, but there you are. Now, after the restoration of Roman Catholicism, he managed to keep hold of the property, but I think that's presumably because of what you were referring to about the Pope.
Well, I think, and it was also acknowledged that, you know, Henry VIII may have been right or wrong to actually seize it, but having done so, it then became a purely commercial matter.
Yes.
So there was no grounds for seizing it back, you know.
No. Well, sometimes they might these days.
They might have done it in any case, yes.
So after Sir William's death, now his widow, Anne, had sheltered many priests, some of whom, it was said, were plotters against Elizabeth's rule. Is there any truth in that, do you think?
No, there isn't. Indeed, she did shelter a number of Jesuits over from France. I mean, Englishmen, but had gone over to be trained in France. It depends what you mean by plotters against the Queen. I mean, they came over to try and wean the country back to Catholicism.
Yes.
But I don't think part of their brief was to dethrone the monarch. Having said that, the cause of all the trouble, if you like, was in 1570, the Pope had issued this bull called Regnans in Excelsis, which excommunicated Elizabeth I from the Roman Church, but at the same time enjoined all Catholics to work for the dethronement of this heretic monarch.
So that would have gone down like a lead balloon.
Well, exactly. So it was only natural that Catholic priests were regarded with great suspicion, and indeed it subsequently became a matter of treason for Catholic priests to be on English soil. They didn't actually have to necessarily say Mass or anything. The very fact they were here, it was assumed they were foreign agents of the Vatican.
Oh, so I mean, because I'd read somewhere that under Elizabeth's rule, Protestants and Catholics were allowed to practice their beliefs, and it was only extremists, if you like, in inverted commas, on both sides, who were persecuted. So that clearly isn't strictly the case.
Not certainly. After 1570, it became increasingly more difficult.
Because it was John Payne posing as Lady Peter Stuart who was executed allegedly just for saying Mass.
Well, he was arrested just for saying Mass, uh-huh. But he'd been portrayed by this scoundrel called Elliot, who actually was a sort of professional priest catcher, if you like, who alleged that there was a plot to actually assassinate the Queen, in which John Payne had tried to inveigle Elliot into joining, but not a word of truth. And so he was actually condemned to death for plotting against the Queen. But it was not so.
Because Lady Peter, she'd hidden these people, but she wasn't executed at all. She died a natural death.
Oh, absolutely.
Why was that?
Well, it's difficult to say, really, because it contrasts, interestingly, with Lady Stoner, who had sheltered Edmund Campion in the same way, and she spent the rest of her life in the Tower. But there is actually a letter to Thomas Mildmay, I think, who was sort of high sheriff or something in Essex, specifically instructing that Lady Peter should not be prosecuted for harbouring Catholic priests. Explain it, I can't.
You don't think it's anything to do with age? I mean, I don't know what the age difference was between her and Lady Stoner.
It could be. The ostensible reason for the letter was that Lady Peter was pregnant at the time, but...
Really? She must have been putting it on, getting on a bit, wasn't she?
Well, yes, but that was the reason given. Whether she was or not, I'm quite... No, I haven't sort of done the sums, but...
Well, look, Lord Peter, thank you very much for coming in and talk to us today. I very much hope you'll come back and talk to us again soon about some of your other somewhat colourful family members. I think we're going to be looking at the 7th, 8th and 9th Lord Peters, are we not, in the future?
I would do so with great pleasure.
That would be wonderful. Thank you very much indeed.